Our next speaker is Ty Burkett. Ty works with Willis Re. He works with the insurance and government clients, advising, modelling, structuring and placing reinsurance solutions. His role really involves understanding the global capital, insurance and reinsurance markets and assisting clients as they develop the most efficient approach to managing the large and extreme risks. He's also responsible for the actuarial and financial modelling team at Willis Re across Asia Pacific, Middle East, Turkey and Africa. Thanks.
Thank you, Corinne. I'm going to speak about managing catastrophe risk, and as you know, the standard different approaches, one of them is to avoid it, and I've done that by spending 13 of the last 18 years working for a broker rather than an insurer. But in that time, you see a range of different approaches, so I'll work my way through it. The way we set up today's session, really, with the three of us, was around sort of three M's: measure, manage, and mitigate. So Michael just spoke about measuring and some of the challenges. The other Michael is going to speak about mitigating. Unfortunately, I don't start with them, but you've got me for the next 20 minutes on manage. So I'll just talk about different ways to manage and some of the things that that you see in terms of managing catastrophe risk. So what I'll do is, when you're not doing Adam's ICAP survey or how is Qantas or how is the Hilton, I'm going to talk about a risk appetite survey that we did. Talk about some of the things that you see, different approaches, good and bad, and then talk about managing extreme events. So in terms of a risk appetite survey, and a lot of this does link back to risk appetite. Obviously, there is a limit to how much capital you're going to have and how much risk you're going to have. The organisation I work for, a couple of years ago, did a survey, risk appetite survey across Europe with Solvency II and everything going on. And then last year, we widened that to a global survey. 240-odd insurers across 50-odd countries, a wide range of territories, a wide range of sizes, and a wide range of ownership structures. The first question you should ask in a risk appetite survey is, do you have a risk appetite statement? And so we asked that question, and it was interesting to see what you saw. Purple is yes, yellow is it's in the mail, and the green is no. Now, interestingly, with different regulatory environments, remembering that APMETA in our language, Asia Pacific, Middle East, Turkey, Africa, covers Australia, Japan, countries like that. High number of people with risk appetite. Fairly straightforward in Australia, similar in Europe. The bit that was interesting was our friends in Latin America and the Caribbean. A lot of them were in the mail, so they said they were going to do one. And in North America, 34%, no risk appetite statement, no intention to do a risk appetite statement. Now, whether that is a function that they're so focused on rating agency capital or whether just the different state-based regimes. Having a look at reinsurance decision-making, I think this is very important when you look at managing catastrophe risk. Where are the decisions made? And you've seen more and more the decisions on things like reinsurance are made at group level. You see, again, Latin America trailing, maybe the nature of the countries there, the culture, the different organisational setups. But in the rest of the territories, a lot more group. And we see that with the Zurichs, the Allianzes, the ACEs, the IAGs, the QBEs out of Australia, taking a real group-level approach. But the other bit I find interesting is when you ask the question about how they look at peers. Having done this for a long time, I actually think this is understated. The dark purple is those who consider peers, the light purple are little, and the green the ones that they don't. The ones that consider the peers are the bigger organisations on the right. Now, they're probably the listed companies worrying about what others are doing, worrying about, Dave said that they're in Zurich, what happens in my Australian exposure? If I'm a global company and I'm overweight Australia relative to my peer group on the Swiss Stock Exchange. So there is a bit more peer comparison. And the reason I say it's overstated is just having done so many benchmarking exercises that you've been asked to do. A lot of large organisations that may or may not be in Japan don't do anything unless they've checked what everyone else in the market is doing. And I think this comes to one of Jeremy's points earlier, is how do you get a competitive advantage of this? If you're always just looking at everyone else, you're not going to get that competitive advantage. So in these circles, what is the key metric when considering reinsurance? I found this interesting as well. If you look at the inner ring, more than 50% in the green look at things like return on economic capital and return on equity. So if you're then looking at how you put the capital against the risk and you're giving weight to the events and you're holding more or less capital, that will influence that metric. If you move to the outer ring, I think some quick maths, more than 70% are looking at profit measures, underwriting results, loss ratios, combined ratios. Once you start doing that, you're not capturing some of that tail risk. So again, another interesting graph. Most important capital measure when considering reinsurance. And again, this is one of the challenges with managing some of this extreme risk is people react to the environment. Yes, APRA does a good job, has a good regime. Yes, the rating agencies are getting more sophisticated with AM Best and S&P and various tests. But again, people are looking to the various things. You'll notice in that meter, a lot of it driven by regulatory capital. When you get to North America with state-based regulations, you talk to any of my North American colleagues, they know the ins and the outs of the capital measures for AM Best and S&P. And I spent my whole time explaining them to ICRC and how it works in them. And so the focuses in different territories are different. So really just giving you a bit of a snapshot of the different things we see in terms of risk appetite and how that flows through. And obviously it's about more than just the extreme risk. So in terms of the type of things that you see, Michael talked about the measure. And I think one of the things, and I'm not going to spend much time on the measure part of the measure, manage, mitigate, but one of the things with the measure stuff is this tendency to set and forget. We work in a city where there seems to be, with insurers and reinsurers, an ability to get agreement on what the 1 in 250 earthquake risk is, much, much easier than the 1 in 5 hail risk. Everyone seems to be quite comfortable with what the 1 in 250 earthquake risk is because RMS runs the models, it gives a number. Everyone thinks 1 in 5 hail risk, if you're a reinsurance broker and you price bottom layers of programs, there's an absolute divergence. So there's an irony with that. I think the next Michael is going to touch a little bit about some of the measure, but you have this situation where people know there is limitations of models. For Katrina, the things that came out of Katrina, some of them were lessons, some of them were known. There was parts of the models for Katrina that everyone knew was not included in the model. They ran the model, they had a nice curve, the actuaries could play around with the curve, slice and dice, portfolio manage, but forgot that certain states and territories weren't covered properly, that certain levy systems were not covered properly, and it wasn't until after the event the realisation that those things had been ignored. Stepping a little bit away from the insurance world and into the finance world, this quote comes up so many times. I don't know what else goes around it, but the CFO of Goldman Sachs talking about 25 standard deviation moves in the market. Now, I'm hoping he then went on to say that then made us realise the model could be wrong, but I don't know. The other one that's interesting, and I won't name names, but a conglomerate in Australia was talking about their DFA modelling, all singing, all dancing DFA modelling as actuaries love, and said the global financial crisis, when they put it in the model, was a 1 in 96 billion year event. Which shows that if you build something off 15 years of credit data, it may not quite capture the tail. Other things you see, simplistic risk appetite. I talked about whether you have a risk appetite or not. You talk about the metric, you talk about the time frame, you talk about the probability, and you end up, well, probably start with some that I've seen. We have a low risk appetite for investment risk and a medium risk appetite for insurance. So you take that the next step, and you might end up with something like no more than a 5% probability of breaching 125% of the APRA minimum. Fine. Do it over 12 months. It meets all those criteria. The challenge you've got, it's too simplistic. If the next question is then should I buy 1 in 500 or 1 in 1,000, well, on that metric, it doesn't do much. In fact, probably the best outcome on that metric is just to buy a 1 in 50 or 1 in 100. So you need those multi-dimensional risk metrics. Another challenge is assuming all the tails of all the distributions are the same. Now, what I've done here, I don't think it's one way of showing, it's probably not the best. I've just taken two different portfolios, some earthquake modelling for both of them. I've rescaled them so they have the same average annual loss. I'll keep moving around so people can see the board. You see on here, the green bar, same average annual loss, but Australia gives a much, much lower number at the 1 in 2, 1 in 5, but to get the same AAO, they have a much higher number at the tail end, which can be seen on the line graph on the other side. But what I'm trying to say here is if you look at two pieces of business with a 1 in 200, they can have very, very different shaped tails. You look at graphs of Australia, earthquake versus windstorm versus other perils. You know, the difference between a 1 in 1,000 hailstorm and a 1 in 200 hailstorm is not going to be as great as the difference between a 1 in 1,000 earthquake and a 1 in 200 earthquake. So when you're managing the cat is don't forget what happens beyond the curve and what happens beyond the AM Best requirement and what happens beyond the APRA requirement. What else do we see? You saw that earlier, this herd mentality and this tendency to be what do others do? Do others allow for this risk? Do others take care of it? The regulator doesn't require me, so I don't need to do it. And as I said, I think this deep purple is completely understated because I hate to think how many of these I've put together over the years in response to questions about what others do. So one of the things is getting a bit away from that herd mentality, talking about what Adam and Jeremy and Stuart talked about in the first session, sitting down, brainstorming, thinking about stuff that is not in the list of boxes that you've got to tick. Uncorrelated correlations. Talked about Hull and property with September 11. It's sort of the thing where you can go post-event, oh, I should have thought of that. The one I always use, the sort of irrelevant example from September 11, is the Ryder Cup got cancelled. So imagine if you're Amlin and you've got the Hull, the property, but when you were writing the property, you weren't actually thinking that it was correlated to your event cancellation policy that you wrote for a Scottish golf tournament. So once you get out into the tail, all sorts of stuff happens. You diversify when you invest. You invest all around the world to get that diversification. But then, I'll come back to that one. You look at 2008, G20, the stock markets all fell. So you can talk about investment theory. Okay, you would have made, I think it was 58% return in Ghana, 11% return in Tunisia, 6% return in Ecuador, minus 94 in Iceland, but you get the point. So there is this correlation in the tail that is not there for the rest of the distribution. The reason I've got the Christchurch one is I talked about 13 years in broking. If I'd been in reinsurance at the time, I would have got very excited about all these backup covers. I would have thought they were beautifully priced. I would have written loads of backup covers. And then got a bit of a hammer in because it turns out the events are correlated over time. So the correlation over time, one of the things that actuaries often get wrong is assuming independence over time. And the other one that Adam talked on, if you've got a life insurance arm, a general insurance arm, and a banking arm, Adam talked about an earthquake that could affect all the different components of the business, the economy as a whole, throw a pandemic in there. Pandemic's got the same impact. Impacts the economy and can impact all three. So correlation in the tail and back to that sensitivity testing scenarios is absolutely key and is something that often gets missed or gets learnt about after the event. The other one, and I do have some sympathy for this view, is the focus on commercial circumstances. If we price for flood, the next asbestos, cyber, nanotechnology, whatever you want to slot in there, our premiums will not be competitive in the current market. So again, we do various different modelling things in the broking world. You talk to a business unit, the current pricing levels are such that a lot of underwriters don't want to have the conversation, and then you're back to those conversations should probably be conversations at a group level rather than an underwriter level. So what do we do in this extreme tail? If I was Jeremy's age and was 30 or so, I'd probably talk about I'd have a nice control cycle picture up here. You know, learn as you go, refine, learn, test, and continue to develop the models. Michael talked about some of the lessons you learn from the models and as you learn over time. Common sense, I'm not a big fan of the old ICA factors, building codes of change, footprints of towns of thing. But again, looking at how big the loss can be, as a percentage of the exposures, a bit of common sense off the top of the model and making sure it makes sense. Ensure the focus is correct. Again, you do all this very sophisticated modelling and then you throw 15% on the top for demand surge, flat assumptions across all loss ratio, across all return periods, across all regions. It's no different to reserving. We discount at two decimal places off the yield curve and then we add on 20% for the risk margin. So it's making sure you stay focused on the key things. If it's not in the model, it still exists. There is a tendency that just because fire following is not in the RMS model for Sydney earthquake and it is a small risk, everyone just goes, well, it doesn't exist. It still exists. It just doesn't happen to be in the model. And again, the correlations. I'm very good at correlation if it's zero, and I'm very good at correlation if it's 100%. I struggle a little bit anywhere in between the two, but again, need to think about it. What else do you need in the extreme tail? People in this room can talk to this much better than I can. The true CRO function, get away from the box ticking, some of the stuff the guys talked about earlier, asking questions and focusing on that group level. So again, making sure you're looking at the big picture. Talks about risk appetite before. What is beyond the 1 in 200? Do you start to use the T-bar measure? You see the global reinsurers looking at what happens beyond the 1 in 200, giving weight to T-bar. The bit that's interesting is someone like IAG or Suncorp in this model, what happens beyond the 1 in 200 is quite critical. Someone like Swiss Re Australia, beyond the 1 in 200, you're going to hit a certain point where just basically every treaty is totaled and every treaty is known and the dollars are known. So their actual extreme tail for Swiss Re Australia may look quite different to some of the direct insurers. So it's, again, thinking about what happens out here. We talked about before about repeat events. They're quite similar to repeat events. And taking that multi-dimensional approach. The bit I think not enough time is spent on is what happens post-event. And this is one of my favourite Far Side comics. You get out, what do you do now? You've had that 20% capital buffer. The event happens, you now have a 2% capital buffer. Where you have to replenish, rebuild, work out what you want to do. We talked about, I think Stuart talked about over time. The event happens, but then a whole series of other stuff happens. Things happen to your competitors. Things happen to the reinsurance market. The reinsurers that were really keen to write your business now don't want to write it at twice the price. What happens to your risk appetite? 5% chance of not falling below 120%. If that organisation fell below 120%, I'm sure management doesn't just sit there and goes, oh, well, that was the 1 in 20-year event, and we'll just keep going. You find there is risk appetite before the event and then risk appetite after the event, and they're quite different things. You have a disrupted managed marketplace. So that is different insurers will be impacted in different ways. So how do you position yourself that when the event happens, there's disruption, there's the ability to rebuild your business? How do you make sure you're in a position to do that? You know, it's been interesting, even just with the smaller events the last couple of years, how the claims burden has had impact on insurers and their focus has changed from one being of rapid growth to one being more operational. So just to wrap it up, I think someone mentioned earlier, capital alone is not the answer. It's a case of managing the risk. You can't have an endless supply of capital. Care with short-term thinking. And I think the other one is the next event will be different. I think, yes, it was 2001 graphics, but after September 11, we saw some of the broken houses build these brilliant models on terrorism risk, which were aeroplanes flying into buildings after September 11. The next terrorism attacks was not going to be aeroplanes flying into buildings. The next event will be different. There's a reinsurer who ran all their models, had a look at all their zones. Okay, we've got a bit too much Wellington earthquake, but AMI write predominantly around Canterbury. So we'll load up on that client rather than these clients because it's not a peak zone, but at no stage did scenario testing. And they no longer exist as a standalone entity. They wrote a lot more on AMI than they wrote on other things. Every event will have unmodeled components. We know that. And the mindset always changes after an event. So there's always the lessons that you learn. I think the next Michael is going to talk a little bit about some of the things that we've learned and seen. But presents opportunities. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a snapshot of some of the things to think about. Dovetails reasonably well into the first sessions this morning. And around the managing side, I'll give it over to Michael to do the mitigate side.